Sometimes the music biz is a terribly exaggerated version of high school. Sure, there are cliques and exclusionary in-crowds in all social circles and workplaces, but nothing comes close to the idiocy encouraged by music biz insiders, furtively dividing and ranking people depending on something so surface as music preference. We all willingly buy into it, too. As someone who plays rock music, people have projected their dull and very outdated idea of how a rocker is supposed to behave and what lifestyle a rocker is supposed to adopt onto me, without even ever meeting me, solely based on the type of music I play. I mean, take punk rock. I look at it as one of the most rebellious forms of music, the kind of music that contains the wildest and most charismatic people one can find, at least on paper. And yet, many times, I have met the most compliant, conformist jerk-offs who play it. Indie rock is viewed as a higher, more refined form of popular music filled with sensitive, emotional artists, but behind the curtains, I've witnessed them behave like it was a Poison concert, with the only difference being a substantially smaller amount of hairspray. This translates back onto the audience as well. Over the years, I've been told by people who listen to the music how I should act, how I should behave, which is usually badly, to uphold some ridiculous rock and roll tradition. I'm struck by these strict rules impressed upon me via a music that supposedly propagates unabashed freedom. It's one of the reasons why I love the music so much, and yet here I am being handed a rule book to follow. I guess what I'm trying to say is people tend to blindly roam within the square boxes built for them like caged pets, not realizing that there really aren't any rules to begin with, especially in something so unrestrained as music. The small amount of self-appointed gatekeepers lining up to tell us what music to listen to, how to listen to it, and with whom to listen to it with is staggering. Usually, and by usually I mean 99% of the time, when I've met these people, the one thing that struck me was their musical knowledge flatlined after Nevermind by Nirvana. Anyways, regardless of these rules, I believe, given a realistic space of time to work within, like minds, like spirits, people cut from the same cloth, will eventually find each other. This overrides any silly regional differences, any fleeting social groupings. It can begin with something so minuscule as noticing someone laughing at a joke nobody else finds funny but you, or liking a band or movie nobody thinks is any good but you. And then you build on that. When I met Toronto rapper Derek Kristoff, aka Decisive, 13 or 14 years ago at, of all places, a comedy club watching Nick Flanagan do stand-up comedy, I do believe there was some recognition between the two of us that, despite what may have been outward differences in social crowds, etc., we were on the same wavelength. Since those early beginnings, I have watched Decisive's career blossom, and he's done it on his own terms. In the conservative cutthroat world of hip-hop, it's refreshing and heartening to see Decisive's on-point but out-of-the-box style embraced. Often people wonder how someone such as Derek can keep things so fresh. I submit this podcast as proof that in order to maintain an edge, you have to be very aware. You have to have a keen sense of humor and the ability not only to laugh at a joke, but become submersed in it, all while remaining outside looking in. Nick and I met up with Decisive a little before Christmas a few months ago to discuss, reminisce, and dish. Anyone interested in checking out his sizable body of work, go to urbnet.com, urbnet.com. Again, thank you to Skull Candy Headphones and Blue Mic Microphones for helping support this podcast. Thank you to you for listening to this podcast and everyone who's left a comment on iTunes or SoundCloud. Please keep them coming. Much appreciated. Okay, Derek Kristoff, a.k.a. Decisive, is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. So we got Decisive on the podcast today.
Decisive.
Very happy. We've known this guy. We both met Decisive together, I believe.
Probably.
Yeah.
At the top of the Rancho Relaxo.
Jerky Treats.
For the Jerky Treats.
Been discussed on the show before, I believe, Jerky Treats.
And
has
he,
it?
Yeah.
Have we talked about it? Yeah.
And
yeah.
He was one of the guys who was there every week when you and I would go and you would do your stand-up.
And I became the king of Jerky Treats for a period of time.
Man, were you there? Were you there that one night? Or maybe two? There was one night where it was like, if you had been a fly on the wall, you would have sworn this guy was going to be on The Tonight Show like next week.
I don't know about that.
Do you remember that?
I think the thing was, there was this really weird combination of people. First of all, I don't know, if people being like, what the fuck is this guy doing? And then being like, this is sort of funny. So then it was like, which is like one of the most fun things in comedy to experience when you're watching comedy.
People were fucking going, Flanagan. Right? Yeah. During other people's sets. Were you part
yeah, yeah.
of that crowd?
No, yeah, for sure. And well, then, I think that's how we became friends.
Yeah,
because I was there with another comedian, but yeah. I think I approached you like on some like fanboy shit. Like, I need to know this guy. I used to request jokes, if you remember that.
Oh shit, you actually gave me jokes. You didn't actually just request jokes, you gave me a joke once. Again, I talked about it before, but it's such an interesting thing about like 13 years ago. Like, nobody knew each other. Everybody kind of was starting off at the same time, and even someone like you was like probably just starting to like really, you know, as a musician, like, go for it. But in comedy, in that scene, everybody was really, really like scared of each other, but manifesting it in like kind of like seeming judgmental or dickish.
Yeah.
Like, people were way, I feel like now the Toronto comedy scene is like all hugs and smiles and shit, but like 13 years ago, Jerky Treats, I feel like it was just a bunch of scared men, you know, like waiting for like the few people who were like really good to perform, like, you know, like Mark Forward or Fraser Young or something.
Well, that's what's crazy, because I used to go every week, like Jerky Treats, the amateur night at Yuck Yucks when it was like the Monday nights. I don't know if it still is.
I think it's Wednesdays now.
Yeah, but I went like heavy, and then I just, you know, I kind of stopped going, you know, and because of the friend that I would go with, we just, you know, kind of drifted apart, and I stopped going completely. But what's kind of cool now is to see, like you mentioned, Mark Forward, and there are a bunch of guys that I'll see on like television, like Comedy Now, and now, and I can say like I've seen their first sets, you know.
Yeah.
So it like totally relates to like, and myself as like a super fan of comedy, it's cool to be able to say that I've, you know, I watched that when it happened. Like,
it's kind of like watching a band before they got signed.
Yeah,
right.
And pretty much like the majority of like Toronto comedians or people from other places that moved to Toronto from that time period, like, I've seen them all, like, their first set, like, bombing completely. Like, and there are even a bunch that I was like, oh man, these guys are shit.
Some of them,
but
still, like, suck.
Yeah. That I actually walked by the other day and saw the poster, and there was like two or three where I was like, this guy's still doing it.
People don't leave here because the stakes are so low. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, even if you're like a working comic in, it's kind of like music, probably. Like, even if you're a working comic in Canada, you are working another job in Canada, you know? Like,
oh, for sure.
Like maybe 8 times out of 10.
Speaking of early sets, I saw Russell Peters open up for Farside at the Opera House.
That's crazy.
And
how
he
did
got
go?
Booed.
Yeah.
He got so booed that I was like, this guy, what's this guy think he's doing? And then I saw him on the cover of Now, and then I saw him warm up a crowd in between the tapings of a Comedy Now show, and he destroyed. Like, just, he was just the MC warming up, like off camera, just warming up the crowd. And I remember I went up to someone who was part of the production team, and I said to her, that guy was the funniest guy tonight. And that was before he blew up the way he did.
He was like the original Drake.
Huh?
Yeah.
Well, no, get it.
I can see that.
It's like, I think he really embodied like a thing about Toronto. You know, the way I think like Drake kind of represents a certain way that a lot of people are in Toronto. Like, I feel like that was why Russell, like, nobody, like, he, only someone from here who, only Russell Peters could have had the like worldwide success. He had this vaguely hip hop Indian guy thing. That's insane.
Yeah, he did. You know? That's how I first found out about him, not through comedy, was he used to DJ on Mastermind Street Jam.
Oh, I didn't know he did that.
I used to come
at CHRY?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
CKLN?
No, Mastermind was...
Mastermind did a
Energy 108. He kind of... He may have started.
Because I was at CHRY when Mastermind was.
Yeah. On college radio, but yeah, that's, there was always that weird thing for a few years where there was, like, urban stations that would then take, like, some serious DJs, like, no pun intended, not DJ Serious, but other DJs. Well,
speaking of DJ Serious, then... I think after the jerky treats where I met you, the next time I saw you, I think, was on the set of a DJ Serious video shoot.
Right, because that was your song, right?
No, it wasn't your song.
Oh, it was another one.
No, it was just a bunch of us, like, as extras, you know, sitting around just doing
Was it Nish Rocks in the Chinese restaurant?
Yes.
Yeah.
You were there, right?
Yeah.
And that's the next time I saw you, and then you were also on that album.
Yeah, like two or three songs.
And... that was something, like, when we first, after we first met, I was kind of like, Jesus, guys, like, done a bunch of shit. Like, your life, because really, I said you were just starting, but that's not really true, because you were, like, a teenager, right, when you were, like, rapping, right? Like,
when I first started.
You were with, like, Len, or doing stuff with Len, right?
Yeah.
Like, pre-Steal My Sunshine, right?
Like,
around the same time?
Around when that started. That's, like, an insane.
Yeah, what's
that's a pretty crazy story.
What's the story?
That ended badly.
P, are you guys...
Me and P are cool.
Okay.
But there was...
He's a cool guy. I like him a lot.
P's amazing. And he, for what it's worth, like, mm-hmm. this is kind of like a shitbag thing to say, but it's just like, he's kind of the one who, like, discovered me. He was the first guy to ever give me, like, a shot.
Yeah.
You know, 95. I was 15 years old. Just, like, terrible. But, yeah. You know, as terrible as any 15-year-old kid would be, I guess.
Outside of Earl, I guess.
Yeah, really. But yeah, so he gave me a shot, and because they used to throw a weekly Planet Mars, and but Kensington Market on College and I think Augusta, College in Augusta, but it was in the back of, it was called the African Lion, or the African something
South
Center.
South African Center.
Yeah, South African Center.
We all were there.
I hate that I said African Lion.
Probably, I can't.
Why did I just say African Lion?
Yeah. South African Center was, like, definitely, it's where this place Neutral is, which is like a goth bar now. It used to be the Lions Club also. And
yeah,
then it
I know
became
that
South
place
African
is.
Center. Yeah.
So I would keep going back there, and my rap name at the time was Malicious.
Of course.
And I remember my first show I did there, that was the night I decided, well, because I used to go by Malicious the Decisive MC.
Ooh.
So.
I actually like that.
So then it was that day that I actually decided I'm going to change it. I'm going to change Malicious and just drop it and go with Decisive. And then so that night, I did my set with my group that I was in then. And a guy, like, fully, like, called me out because his rap name was Malicious as well. So Planet P called me up and it's like, I got this guy that wants to battle. And I was like, what? He's like, battle for the name.
And you were 15 battling for the name Malicious.
That I wasn't even using anymore.
Okay, did you win? Won?
I did. I won.
Do you know that guy? You know Malicious? Old Malicious?
Do you know Malachi the Nutcracker?
I know Malachi the Nutcracker well. But anyways, from there, then I just rolled with Phil and Abdominal and, like, Cryptic Souls crew. And then they became friends with... Mark Costanza from Len and Derek McKenzie, and then it just felt like overnight those guys were just around all the time, or we were involved in there.
And it seemed like from there was this, like, long term sort of scene in Toronto that was, like, you had, like, all these different DJs who were really skilled and people and, like, rappers. I don't know. I feel like there's, like, a lot of talent that actually was in Toronto from, like, the 98 or 99 on. And, you know, it was just really a question of the usual thing of, like, well, where can it go?
Yeah.
You know, like,
and truthfully, you know, it really went nowhere.
You also went across country with our sound man. Remember that?
Yeah, Corey.
Corey Shields is our sound man. And DJ Sirius did a cross Canada tour, and you were on it. Nish Rocks was on it. Who else was on it? There's a couple other people.
It was me, Nish, and just two breakdancers from Bag of Tricks.
Right. And I remember Corey coming home from the tour going, yeah, you and Decisive would probably get along. And I was
well,
I
remember
him.
Like, quiet? Not doing much, hanging out.
Well, those guys were pretty much smoking weed. I would hang out with Corey all the time.
Yeah.
Like on that entire tour. And I remember, like, even like the long 10-hour treks, you know, everyone would be sleeping in the van and I would be sitting in the front with Corey while he like drove, and we just
it's really important to be a good shotgun guy. Yeah. You know, you can't fall asleep in that shotgun.
I was a good shotgun guy.
At some point, you know, maybe a few times. It really depends on your mentality. Like, I've stayed over at people's houses a million times. And again, this is something I think we've talked about here, but it's, like, such an interesting... I think it's so interesting. Like, just that in rock and in... or music and any kind of touring, you fucking wind up sleeping on some guy's house.
But as a rapper...
Because you save money.
Do you go on tour? Like, how does that even work? Yeah. That's why I'm always interested.
You've been to Europe, right?
Yeah. Well, I remember seeing you guys in Europe once.
No way.
Yeah, or no, I don't think I saw you, I think I saw Corey.
Oh, he should have told me.
Or no, how did it work? But I think it was at like Leeds and Reading or
one of
those. You toured the UK.
With DJ Format.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was another like connection through Abdominal. That's cool. He did a lot of work with DJ Format out there, and they had like a couple of big songs. And then when Format did his sophomore record, they wanted to expand. Like, he was thinking about maybe starting a band, or just to make it more than just a turntablist and a rapper.
Getting something together.
And then Abs recommended me, and I remember Abs calling me up and just saying, "Hey, I'm doing this." I didn't really think anything of it because, not just then, even now, you get so many empty promises that never happen. So he's like, "Yeah, man, I'm gonna talk to Format. Maybe we can go on tour in the UK." And I'm like, "Okay," but like really, I'm like, sure, whatever, it's not gonna happen, but for sure. And then so we ended up recording one song a week later, and then like 2 weeks later I get this itinerary. It's like, you know, 30 shows in 35 days, like just like insane. Like, and like my first show was like Leeds and Reading. That was like my first show, and I walk out and they're like, mind you, I'm not sitting here boasting by any means because I'm like the third wheel, like nobody has any idea who I am, but it's like my first show, I walk out in front of like 10,000 people and I'm just like, what is happening here?
But that's an interesting thing about yourself that's, like, I think is weird. Is like, you do something like that, but then you kind of have, like, the technical skill that it's gonna be fine, right? Do you know what I mean? Like, you're like, a pretty skilled rapper. So it's, like, I guess I don't even really have a question. It's just, like, is that weird knowing that you're, like... capable at any point?
Well, you know what I mean? I see what you're saying, but like, I got shit on a lot on that tour. I can swear, right? That's fine.
I got
shit on like a lot on that tour because like
British people,
because like Abdominal and I are like two,
I love you, Ringland,
we're completely different artists, you know. Like, and at that time, like, he had a song called The Hit Song, and he'd incorporate the word hit. Like, my song's a hit. More hits than Barry Bonds and more hit. You know, it's a good song.
Yeah.
But, like, we're just completely different styles, right? So when a lot of the reviews would come out, and I'd be excited because I had never really been mentioned in anything before, like, at that level. But then I'm just getting shit on everything. Like, everyone... I remember doing one show, I think it was in, like, Brighton, and the entire time there was, like, a guy just like this... sticking his middle fingers up, just standing right there, and everyone else is just kind of enjoying the show. Because a lot of, if you listen to the Format songs, it's like, I guess, dancey. I don't want to say poppy, but like, I don't know, happy.
Yeah.
You know, a total opposite of anything that I make, right?
Right.
And just standing, and I'm trying to ignore it, and I'm trying to fight the urge to like kick this guy in the fucking face. Like, I'm just like, but you know, you just take, but I've never experienced that, because then when I come home, it's not like I'm doing anything remotely big like that here, but I have like my crowd. I have my underground, my backpackers, my freestylers, and
you've got your king of the dot people.
I'm fine here, but then I go over there and it's like I'm so excited, you know. I'm like, and especially the first show being that, so it's like we had this whole routine in the track where he's just like, now introducing, because Abs can rap really fast and say a lot of words. So he does this whole thing and hypes me up, and I walk out. Nobody has a fucking clue who I am, but you know, I have it on tape. And there's just like 10,000 people lose their shit. And I'm like, I'm fucking famous, man. Yeah. This shit's going down now. And then we're like, where's the next show? And they're like, Brighton. And I'm like, I'm ready to kill it. And then the whole time, a guy's just sticking his middle. I'm like, what happened to Leeds and Reading?
That's a funny thing, right? When you get excited. You've talked about that before, right, Danko? Like touring and stuff and dealing with the person.
Oh, my
God. The two middle finger person is like a mainstay, it seems like, in certain types of concert and situations.
I've fucked with those people before.
Yeah.
And it's fun. It's fun as hell.
At that time, I didn't have the confidence or any preparation.
Day two,
Now, whereas now, it's like, I'm more known for, I'm not trying to take the story from you, but I'm like more known for like my banter than I am for the actual songs. Like people come to my shows to hear like...
That was another thing. Even back then, I remember when we first met you, everyone would talk like about your live shows like it was the craziest thing in the world. And I went and I saw... I can't remember if it was the one at the Drake or the one at the Horseshoe. I went to one. It was great. And it was, but you would have like comedians up, and you would have like what kind of things? What would you do at some like of the
back
shows?
Then?
Yeah, back then.
Back then, it was like that's when I think you're probably talking around like 2001.
Yeah, between 2001 and 2003, probably.
Yeah, around. I focused more on like theatrics back then. Like I used to like, and you know, and. It obviously shows I was going to comedy nights like four nights a week, right? So that, like, I love that. So I always wanted to incorporate that kind of shit in my shows. And I don't know, I'd go to Malabar and just rent like costumes, like mascot costumes. It'd be fucking weird shit. And then like, and then I'd get like, the next thing I know, like, I'm on the cover of Now magazine,
right?
And you know, I have management contacting me from like the States. Yeah. Like, it's just like, it was just such a weird. I've had so many weird times in my life, but it was always like, and this is not a feel sorry for me thing, but like I was always missing one thing, and then finally I kind of disappeared, and I come back in 2008 with actual music, and no one's like, it's all gone. Like all the opportunities.
Yeah, we got that shit too.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
I remember we serviced our demo tape to some producers and record labels. They go, you don't got the songs. Like you only got two parts. You got this thing and this thing that's kind of a chorus, and then you got a verse type thing. And then we came back to the same people in 02, 03, and they're like, you know, let's do an album like, see, the Hives are really big, and they're doing what you were doing back in 96. We got to do it. The same people who told me that we just have one verse and one chorus were the same people. And that's when I just I remember it too. I was in Sault Ste. Marie in a motel talking to this big time producer who told me in 98 that we didn't have the songs. In 2002, he told me that we got to do this shit you were doing in 98. And that's when I realized these people, no matter how vaunted they are, they do not know what the fuck they're talking about.
No, zero.
But more than that, it's like the chutzpah that it takes to fucking just do that, to like say the thing that's the opposite of that you said before, and act like everything's normal when you've actually completely contradicted your own wisdom, and like it should all be in question. You know, it's amazing to me, and it's that the sad thing is, it's that kind of bullshit that seems to impress people and get those people jobs, and yeah. You know, like, it's,
well, hey,
well, that's the kind of thing that has maybe irritated me the most, and I guess now we're kind of going down that
bitterness.
We're going down Angry Avenue.
I want to go into Positive Avenue after Angry Avenue.
All right. And then you're reading all the reviews, and every paper, I'm not exaggerating, every newspaper, like with their Juno prediction, who will win? Cardinal, Dangerous, right. Who should win? Decisive.
I'm
like, so you're saying I got a shot? Like, shit's gonna fuck up, my birthday's gonna go down. And then the winner, and it's on TV, so because they always rotate when the rap.
Did you get up before they even announced it?
And I'm even my seat was like far from the stage. I'm behind like Nickelback, but you're like a distance. So I'm like, it's okay. It'll be a fun walk up, like wrestling. Like, no, just like
you're like doing the family
you're not
circus.
Even thinking
you're
that
doing
yet.
Your family circus drawing of like Jeffy taking him to the fucking thing. Oh, I hope not me doesn't get in the way of my way to the stage.
And then Cardi, just that name gets read off the card. I'm like,
and he's on the second row. He's the second row or something.
Already up there. He read it himself. And then that was it. Then reality set in. And
but you must have been
A little bit. you must have been a little bit like, well, that's okay, right? Like,
oh, I mean, yeah.
You
know,
it's not like you were against someone. Someone like Cardinal Official has like,
in that's Canada, a good guy to lose to.
Yeah, he just has
set. At the time.
He's very talented. At, yeah,
well, because
yeah.
That was a big now song.
Now if you lost to him, it would be weird.
But it would be like, you know, we took a flight with him maybe 2 years ago, three years ago. He was in first class.
Yeah.
His crew were sitting with us in economy.
I don't know. I feel like there's like a whole world of Toronto musicians who somehow managed to like make a pretty awesome living. And
I'm sure
they haven't had.
What's that guy, Sean? What's that guy?
Sean Desmond?
No, not Sean Desmond.
Sean Paul.
Cullen?
Sean Paul.
Well, Sean Paul is like a huge
Cardinal is in the video. I'm sure that money's still pouring in. How about HDV?
Oh, God. Well, what about Devin, right?
I'm a pick of the mic.
What about Devin, Mr. Metro?
Mr. Metro.
What about Rumble, Safe, you know?
Like I grew up in Dufferin, Eglinton area, like Eglinton, Oakwood.
Yeah.
And I remember one day I went to Fairbank Park where my building was. And I used to go there every day. And summertime, school's out, so my friends and I would either be there at the swimming pool. I must have been like 10, I guess, 1990. And Devin was there playing softball with like a bunch of friends. But I remember that being like a super like mind fuck to me. I was like, what's Devin doing here? Like, and those are the times where you think anyone who's on Much Music is like famous.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just Hollywood,
like,
man. Yeah.
Like, well, Devin is here. And I'm saying to my friends, do you know who that is? No.
Right.
Like, and the 10-year-old that didn't give a shit.
I was at a concert once at Sneaky D's in Toronto. I'm like a teenager. It was before Pulp Fiction. It was this band Wig was playing. Ooh. And
I remember Wig.
And Nash Cato. From
Urge Overkill
comes in and is watching the show, and I'm like, to my friend, I'm like, that's Nash fucking Cato. I'm just like, what are you doing? You just read about this guy twice in spin, and you're acting like he's your dad or something that you haven't seen in 30 years. Like,
did you go up to him? Did you go out to him?
No, I was too scared. And I also had a Devin moment also where we were like outside of this like day Beck concert right when Loser came out, and at the Rivoli. And, yeah, he, like, passed by, and everyone was like, that's Mr. Metro, and it's like, and, you know, it's weird that,
and he had a softball equipment?
Yeah, exactly.
There's a big bag of
and you were chasing him, and there was, like, you know, there was so many fans like that because
now I know why
videos.
I had the baseball mitt. Oh, look at all the washed-up wrestlers who used to be superstars now.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to call anyone out. They're awesome even when I see them today, but they're not doing well.
No. Well, I didn't realize how ill, like, Bobby Heenan is now.
He's very old, though, isn't he?
Yeah. You heard him in an interview?
No.
I don't know. I think that he had his jaw removed.
That doesn't have to do with wrestling, though.
No. Health. Cancer. He had, like, cancer. Right. But I'm just saying, like, so then, because I looked him up. And I was just reading shit, and like, I think it was like 2 years ago, and he's at an autograph signing, but it's like,
yeah, you're like, this guy is ailing. But, why is he doing this?
Yeah, and he's it looked like so shitty, like just like a fold up table, like nothing that you'd even think, like, you know, like you think, because to us, like to me, Heenan's like fucking royalty.
He's the
like,
weasel,
he's the
man.
Best.
He's the best.
Yeah. But then just to see him there and he's giving the thumbs up and it just looks dirt, like he's in like a garage.
Yeah.
And it's just,
and
you
that
know
movie,
that
the wrestler really captured it, I think.
Yeah. It did. And I mean, it's funny, but you know, you see that in fan conventions with sci-fi and horror actors, you know, like it's just, it's across the board, like something that can happen to entertainers, I think, you know. It's sad to say, but
well,
it's like
Corey Feldman still does those
really
signings, you know. He was at one recently,
and Corey Feldman is probably one of the better off like child catastrophes.
Yes.
Did you see his last music video? He
I
made?
Heard about it.
Amazing.
It.
The one,
amazing.
The one take.
Yeah, the one take one.
It's amazing.
Brilliant.
You read his book, Choreography. read.
You take it to the next level.
No, but you know what I want to read too.
Choreography is amazing. Right, the introduction to I bought it the first day it came up,
this.
And even just from the introduction, I was like, this like, I'm
I feel
I have
I did
like
read it.
I'm obsessed with Corey Feldman, but like. But I watched the video. I sent them to my friends. Like, did you watch
it? Dude, I saw it like 5 times.
Did you see him in the figure skating competition in the UK? Look that up. And he and when he does his, it's like a Battle of the Blades type show.
Right.
He dances, and when he, his promos, he puts on like a bit of a fake English accent, like, and because there's one where he finally gets to do a Michael Jackson song.
Yeah, he's and got then this thing
and
then
he
him.
Yeah, and he goes, I think because of my history with Michael Jackson, my ability to dance, and he's talking. I'm like, this guy's blowing my fucking mind. Like, he's the like, and then I hear that, and I'm like, he's the greatest person alive, right? Yeah, and all my friends are like, this guy's a loser. What do you care so much? But when I got the book, the introduction, like, not even in chapter, like, you think maybe chapter halfway through, it's gonna get, when we get to the Goonies, it's gonna get real.
Never gets real.
No, it's real from page one. It just starts with, I woke up to 100 text messages telling me Corey Haim had passed away. And it's like, everything was a blur. I tied up my bathrobe. Like, every detail is like, he's putting, like, because he thinks he's fucking killing it.
And I looked at my expensive toilet paper and I thought, if only I could have used this as a tourniquet for Haim. Emotional wounds.
Because I, you know, he goes, I make my way slowly down the steps, and my publicist, and like, your publicist is there. You wake up in the morning, your publicist is at your house, and he's like, the press is about to create a, and I love talking in his voice and his fake figure skating
voice.
Accent.
Voice.
Yeah.
But that's what
he's like.
Says.
Yeah, he's like, they're about to start a press conference outside of my garage, and he goes, but I can't even think straight. My best friend had just passed away, and then my publicist is hounding me, and this is said in the book. My publicist is hounding me. You need to release a statement and speak to press. I can't even think. All I want to do is take a shower, and then I look at my publicist and I say, call Larry King. And I was like, yeah. Like, I'm getting hype at home. Like, you know, like, my girl's getting, she's like, shut up. I'm like, no, you don't get it. You, Larry King.
I read a big article about that book, now that I think of it, because that's pretty recent, right?
Yeah, it just came out.
And it was so depressing because it really outlined all of the stuff he talked about. And it really outlined that he is more than willing to say things that happened to Corey Haim that people might not want to, if I were Corey Haim, I might not want to you know, like,
really?
He was just, Michael Jackson. A lot of molestation stuff, a lot of drug stuff.
Corey,
you know.
Haim's molestation?
Oh, yeah. A little bit.
That's not his tale to tell.
Oh, and I don't even think that was even told when Corey Haim was alive.
No.
And he brought it all out after Haim died. That's
because
it's
his trump card. He says, like, his first time he says he met Corey Haim was like, that Corey Haim was like, hey, this guy had sex with me. Why don't we, or like, you know, why don't we do the same, you know, like it was just, it's just really dirty. But the crazy thing is that it's so depressing, and it's really this interesting thing about people who do things that you like, because okay, I liked Corey Haim in Stand By Me, and or Corey Feldman in Stand By Me, and I like Corey Feldman in the Goonies, and I liked him so much in those two movies that, just like you said, there's some element of me that's like, thinks he's okay or something. I don't know. And I didn't even like him in Lost Boys. I thought he was already irritating by the time Lost Boys came along. And
long hair.
Yeah, and he's trying to do this fucking shtick with Corey Haim that kind of sucks. And Lost Boys is a bit overrated anyway.
I feel that, mind you, with what I'm about to say, I have to put the disclaimer that I still love Corey Feldman, but I feel like Feldman took Haim down. I feel like, because like, Lucas is like one of my favorite movies of all time.
That's a really good Corey Haim movie.
Like, if you look at Haim, like, Haim could have been something. I believe it. I think Haim could have,
River Phoenix type or something.
I feel like it.
Who also
died. But then I even feel that if Haim got the right role when he came back.
Oh, that would have been it.
I feel like he could have done his, like, Mickey Rourke, his wrestler. Like, if he could have just got the right, I think Feldman then just said, hey, let's do this fucking A&E show. The two boys,
so
we're back,
much,
bro.
It takes so
and then
much
was just
luck.
Down.
Yeah.
He used to live, he used to work at the Indigo bookstore,
yeah,
man. We used to go
right?
Look at him. Like,
didn't you work at HMV?
Yeah. A friend of mine told me this, and now I'm totally being Corey Feldman.
Well,
but like,
but you didn't grow up with it.
You know what
I mean? It's,
a friend
it's
of
okay.
mine worked at the HMV, and his mom used to come down all the time and buy DVDs for him. Because I guess when he finally moved back here from LA, he was defeated, whatever, finished. And his mom used to go and buy DVDs for him. Like, she'd go downstairs, and then he'd say it was like clockwork. 2 or 3 hours later, Haim would come down and, like, return them.
The thing that's weird is,
do you think Feldman's self-aware, though? Like, do you think he knows what he's doing?
No, that video alone should tell you.
I think that
fucking
some
Michael Jackson moves in like 2013, but it makes 2012.
But that's what's bizarre to like, and that's what keeps me coming back. Is I guess there's a little bit of me, like, you know, the Goonie fan,
really?
That wants to think that he knows what he's doing, because what person would do this? And even if you read the stories about him and Michael Jackson, he's like throwing him under the fucking bus.
Yeah.
But like Michael Jackson, kind of like, if you, the story, he kind of sells him out. It all happened on September 11th. That's when it all went fucking downhill.
Right, yeah.
They were together in New York.
September 11th, 2001.
Who was together?
Michael Jackson and Corey Feldman. There's a photo of them in the book. It's their last photo together, and it was September 11th.
That's a long friendship.
And then they woke up, and it, all that shit happened.
Where did they wake up?
Like, well, not together, but like in the hotel or whatever. And Michael Jackson just left him in New York. Like, Michael Jackson got on his private jet and fucking bounced. But that's Feldman's account of it, right?
Oh, and by the way, yeah, for Corey Feldman to be like, I can't fucking believe Michael Jackson took off on me. It's like, I can't believe two adult men separated the day of a disaster. You know, it's like.
But then you hear the story of them becoming friends, like on the Goonies set, and they used to talk on the phone for like 3 hours, and like Feldman's like 8, and Michael Jackson's 26.
I'm a Goonie.
And Feldman used to be jealous of Webster because he wanted to be doing with Webster.
He wanted to be carried.
That friendship. And then when
he wanted to be always hoisted.
It's
like
crazy.
A little koala bear.
But it's just, I don't get how someone can be that not self-aware.
I think that at some point,
because what fame does to you.
You've been famous since you're 8.
He's got to know that he's getting clowned. Like, even like when the Vice article, did you read that?
Oh, about when the sex with him or whatever, like the orgy in his house or whatever.
And like, so they were able to get in. That's actually an amazing read. And they kind of like just broke down the party. So Feldman invites Vice and lets him come in.
This is for real.
But yeah, because Feldman's trying to become the next, what's his name? I can't think of his name. Fucking Playboy.
Hugh Hefner?
Yeah. So he has like Corey's Angels, and he has these parties at his house, and
prostitutes.
And you pay like, there's packages. Like, we can go, but we'd have to pay, like, there's a $500 package where you get a girl for the night. Like, you know, you get your own. It's crazy. You can find it. So then Vice got in somehow. They said, we're gonna do an article. And then they stay that it, like, they took pictures of the part, like everything they wrote. There's a photograph, like that's the captions are the best part. Like, and this guy's just like kind of a dirty house. Like, it's just like, it's the most creepiest party of all time. And then they released the article. And then now I think Feldman's like threatening to sue them for defamation.
So this just got released,
maybe two months ago.
So it's fairly recent.
This was around the same time I read that article about the book. There was this other article about him having sex, which, if you think about it, is maybe it's bad press, but it also coincided with the release of his book. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like so many articles these days. It makes the writer seem like a creep because they're like, oh, and then I made out with this guy who said he was friends with Corey. You know what I mean? Like, it's someone who's like,
so they
I thought I would fucking go to Corey Feldman's thing to have fun, you know, to make fun of him, and then he fucked me and whatever. He's a loser, and it's just like,
but they partook in sucks. Everything that,
yeah, they
that
were
he
partaking.
Was offering.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well, so that kind of makes them.
But that's society nowadays, is this thing where people go like, oh, I'm participating in this bullshit. You know, like, it's like, it's weird. And it's like, yeah, of course I sucked this dictator's cock. Because I needed to write about it.
I needed another paragraph. Yeah, a concluding paragraph.
And you know, like, it was a bitter taste. It left a bitter taste in my mouth. Oh.
I remember.
Yeah, when you watch.
This is kind of embarrassing to say, but like, I remember finding out the release date. Like, I don't remember what the release date of the book was. But I remember it being like, let's just say fucking November 10th. I'm just throwing November 10th out there, and that's Tuesday, and books come out on a Tuesday. Yeah. So, and I don't know why, but it was like Saturday morning. I woke up, and my kid's still asleep. My girlfriend's still asleep. And I remember just going on the Indigo website and just typing in choreography just to make sure it was still Tuesday. And they have the section of the website where it says, like, check store availability, and just for the hell of it, I just like, let's just click, and then I just see unavailable because it comes out Tuesday. But then I saw World's Biggest Bookstore 5, and it's like 7 in the morning. I'm like, what the fuck? And I'm just like, then I'm trying to make excuses with my girlfriend. Hey, we should go downtown. Like, maybe. And she's like, well, I don't know. Maybe we can just go kick in the park. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, you got to get anything by World's Biggest Bookstore? Like, I just had to go in that day. And then, like, I buy the book. I'm like, what am I? Who am I? I don't even
know. But you got it on the Saturday?
Duh, it was sold. And bought.
You finished it, what, Sunday night or something?
Was he selling it? Like, was he the cashier? Little visor.
I tweeted him not too long ago too, and he replied back.
No. Oh, how is that for you? What kind of feeling?
I can't remember what the tweet was. It was incredible.
You guys have to watch the fucking Larry King Hulu show. By the way, have you seen my Instagrams I put up?
Yes, I have.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah, I will. Is that how we end it?
Yeah.
No, say it again.
You guys have to.
No. The game.
The game is to be sold, not to be told.
Hey, little soldier, you ain't ready for war. 1, 2, 3, down for the count. Get rock the game.
D is that guy.
You just got pissed.
You ain't ready for war.
I came, I saw, I'm coming.
This is where you and the bottom of my shoes meet.
Decisive. You will respect me.
I'm Fred Astaire on the canvas. I'm Sammy Davis. Gregory Hines in his tap shoes on crack pavement. You're in the presence of a champion who's half made it. Nobel holding up his pants with his hands raised up. Skipping rope in a dim, damn basement. Shadow boxing between a wall and a lampshade. All I see is you and my level of anger raises. I jab stronger and harder and move caffeinated. A combination of passion and rage. A raging bull in a china shop shattering glasses and vases. I want your blood splattered on your fans' faces. The fans who've never asked me to autograph my name. A name nobody knows. From the waterfronts to the suburbs, the projects to the barrios. Mighty Kong to white dreads and college dorms. Lit spliffs burning like Paul Walker with Marley on. Blanco on a Ducati rolling up to Yo Adamo and pierce two shots through your Bugatti door. Adios, on to the next. I'm off, gone with the wind. I wanna see fireworks exploding above me. A sold out crowd on their feet. Crying, telling me they love me. My album loud on the speed curve. Maybe I won't, maybe I will. Maybe I won't, maybe I will. Maybe I won't, maybe I will. There's a thousand yous and only one of